Hey everybody, welcome to Eyes on Investors. I've got a new interview here for you, and my guest today is Rudy Ringel. He is an investor and an inspector up in the Dallas area. He's been investing in real estate since the mid-1980s, and we had a great conversation about what to do with retirement funds, whether you should leave them in the stock market or take them out and put them in real estate. We talked a lot about inspections and what inspectors look for and how investors we can benefit from that. Great conversation, lots of great ideas. I hope you enjoy it. Do you have rent houses in like the Dallas area up there?
Yes, I have a couple in McKinney and two in Fort Worth that are I just closed on one this past Wednesday.
Oh, cool.
And so I just closed on another it's my own little discovery of a niche market of renting to college students,
Oh.
renting the bedrooms out, you know, like a almost like a having a threeplex. If you have a three bedroom, you rent out three bedrooms to, you know, individual leases, individual renters, you know.
Right.
And then they have all the common areas of the regular common areas of the house to share. And hopefully you get somebody that, you know, they all know each other, or they know each other somehow.
Yeah.
So anyway, I did that for my daughter. And then this other house came up. It was up the street. It was, you know, sounded like a pretty good deal, and it was, you know, 4 or 5 miles away. And so we went and looked at it and bought it. And so now I'm in the process of renovating it and getting it all painted and getting it ready, because you know, school was just out, and it's going to start again real soon, because everybody's looking for a place to live next fall.
Yeah, they get ready
So
weeks in advance.
So I've got to really hustle.
Yeah. So where do you advertise properties that are for students? Are there like directories that the students are all looking in?
Yes, but the best one is word of mouth and a sign in the yard.
Okay.
It's real simple. And
So
most of it's word of mouth. You usually find one student or two, one or two students, and they have you know, another friend, or maybe there might be a you know, threesome or a foursome of friends that are, you know, living in one place, but now they don't want to live there anymore. So now they want to, because these are walking distance to campus. It's two blocks off campus.
Oh, that sounds like a good location.
So you know, I get a lot of calls. I have been getting a lot of calls from people that were, you know, live further out, you know, that had to drive back and forth to campus, and now they're, you know, they're looking to move in closer.
Right. Okay. Well, that's cool. So if you do the rents work out better, like if you get three students in a three bedroom house, could you, and well, yeah, let's say compare that to if you just had a family living in there and you just charge one rent, can you actually make more by the three students than just a single family?
Yeah, kind of. Because you have to take into consideration too that I'm paying all the bills, so I'm including gas and electric and you know, the first year I had the one, you know, I just kind of guesstimated, you know, what the electric bill was going to be for the summer,
Right.
and it really kind of makes it up. So over time, you know, the three tenants or four tenants, about $50 or $75 of their monthly payment is actually going towards expenses.
So you just have to factor that in.
So, but to answer your original question, yeah, you can get more for the house if you do it individually like that, as opposed to just trying to, you know, rent it out to a family or, you know, just like one tenant. You know? Because these houses would probably rent for, you know, I don't know, maybe $1,200, and I'm getting closer to 2,000.
Okay. Per student? Per
Yeah,
person?
total.
Oh,
A month.
total.
So it's roughly $600 to $700 per bedroom, per student.
Okay, I gotcha. I gotcha.
That's
So.
pretty much the going rate. I mean, that's, you know, if you were to get an apartment or something, you know, even if you could find a one-bedroom apartment for yourself, you'd probably pay upwards of $700 to $800.
I see.
For one-bedroom apartment. So this is really kind of a big deal for them.
Yeah, it sounds like a really good deal. That's good. So I get, is a downside to that that there's a little bit more turnover than you'd usually have?
Right. Well, it's almost annual, I guess.
Yeah.
To give you an example, I have two students that they're in their second year now, so they'll be there another year. I only had to find, for the one house, I only had to find one more roommate.
Uh-huh.
Which they found. I mean, they knew somebody that wanted to move in with them, and they did. So
that's cool.
I didn't have to do anything.
That's nice.
Yeah. And so the new house now, we just closed on it this past week. I put a sign in the yard. I've been getting calls. You know, I probably have five or six people, ready to call back to, see and a lot of them are, I have two roommates, or I know two other people, or I know another person. So that everybody knows somebody that's looking for a place to live.
Right.
So that's kind of like that's the easy part about renting to students. You don't really have to, have to worry about, credit checks and like background checks and credit checks, and if they have a job. If they lose their job, then you're 100% vacant,
Right.
So it's kind of like the best of both worlds, even with multifamily, only in a single family.
Yeah.
So with multifamily, the best thing about multifamily is the economy of scale. You'd have so many more tenants and income, so that whenever you have one tenant move out, you're not, vacant.
Right. You still have all the cash flow from the other tenants. So the students, yeah, I can see that. If you got three or four students in a single property and one has to move out, you still got the others there, and chances are you'll get another one coming in. So.
Right. And like I said, they all know, people that are looking for places to live.
Right.
Let's see what else I can tell you. But, well, another aspect about that, too, is that I have their parents on as a responsible party. They're students, and they don't work.
Right.
So, they have to try and show somehow that, they have money to pay for the monthly rent. So I have their parents on as a co-lessee, I guess, I call them a responsible party signer, and they sign on to it also. So they're more or less guaranteed. They're like a guarantor.
I see. That makes sense. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I figured that out all by myself. that works out really well. So I have the parents, and then because it's usually not co-ed, it hasn't been co-ed. I've been renting mostly to female college students.
Uh-huh.
I learned that from my daughter, because my daughter was the first one, she was one of my first tenants.
Okay.
So she told me that, to try and rent only to girls, because all the boys have all the parties.
Yeah, I was going to say, I bet the girls are not as hard on their
girls
apartment.
Are not difficult to deal with, and boys, they don't keep it clean, they don't do anything to the house, But anyway, she said to try and just rent it to girls. And I said, okay, that's not the truth. So anyway, the parents are kind of reassured, too. I have a little clause in the lease, too. So, only one person can live in a bedroom.
Right.
No roommates,
Yeah. Well, yeah, that will help the parents feel better.
The parents kind of know that, their daughter is going to be living with another TCU student. So nobody off the street is coming in, to live. That isn't a student, or might be, a guy. Anyway, it kind of gives them that reassurance. And I also have a monitored alarm system, for safety.
Right. Okay.
So anyway, those are all included in all the monthly rent.
Yes. Okay. So that's an interesting model. That was really interesting and cool to find out about. And you mentioned, so you do have some other single family properties that you rent out. And I'm curious on that, like, what was the first property that you bought? How long ago was it?
And
what
was it? Let's see, the first rental was in California.
Oh, really?
It was in Eagle Rock. I think it was in Eagle Rock. Yeah, Eagle Rock, California.
Okay.
And my wife and I used to live in, up and down the San Fernando Valley. That's kind of where I got my start in contracting and inspecting. And it was a little bungalow, maybe a two-bedroom. Just really run down, you know. I think it was $170,000 in like 1985 dollars.
Yeah.
So it was pretty expensive, and you couldn't live in it. So this is Los Angeles. So this is the kind of property you get in Los Angeles.
Right.
$5,000, and you can't live in the house because it's just so bad. So I bought it, and we renovated it. And,
uh-huh.
And actually, we were going to rent it out, but then we renovated it and decided to just flip it. So then we just put it right back on the market and sold it.
Okay.
We didn't hold it that long.
Did it work out for you? Were you able to sell it for more than you bought it, plus all your fix-up
costs?
Yeah,
we made a little bit of profit. I think we made something like $25,000 or something like that.
Okay. So that was your first experience. It wasn't a total killer deal. But it worked out okay, so.
Yeah, and it was definitely a learning experience.
Yeah. So what motivated you to go buy that property? What was going on through your mind?
Well, we wanted to get started getting some real estate in a portfolio, you know, for like a retirement portfolio, which is what I'm, you know, still doing today.
Uh-huh.
Only at that time, we just didn't really have a plan and didn't really know that much about it. You know, I went through all the tapes and the DVD. Well, at that time there were VHS tapes,
yeah,
and cassette tapes, you know, from Carlton Sheets, and I forget how Dell names off all those.
Yeah,
tapes.
He's got this. He looks them all off.
The Carlton Sheets, and I can't remember. I had a bunch of those that I kind of learned how to buy a property like that. And, you know, what to do with it next. And I remember he had like a little checklist. And this was kind of just at the same time that I was getting into home inspections. Because I was, at that time, I was still a general contractor. And I was doing remodeling. I had like a kitchen and bath remodeling business.
Mm-hmm.
Burbank, Glendale, Pasadena here. And so anyway, that's kind of what, when I started getting into working more with real estate, realtors, and inspecting houses for other people who were thinking about buying them. Because if you remember, like back in the mid '80s, you know, nobody really knew what a home inspection was, or you know, why do I need a home inspection? I'll just have my Uncle Bob, you know, come by and look at it. He's an electrician or something.
Yeah.
So then that was kind of the attitude back then, you know, and that's when I got started in home inspection. And I remember Carlton Sheets had this, like an inspection sheet, you know, when you go to look at a property, this is what you want to look at. So you check off the windows and the carpet and you know, what does the bathroom look like? You know, am I going to remodel, you know, do I need to do anything to this or paint that room or whatever? So he had a checklist that I started using as a home inspection.
Uh-huh.
Was one of my first home inspection checklists.
Okay.
This was back when everything was handwritten. I first got started in taking photos in home inspections with just a little 110 camera. And so I would.
Whoops. Rudy, it looks like we're frozen. Your video froze there for a minute. The last thing I heard was you took a little camera.
Yeah. You know, we have internet connection problems. Are you reading me okay?
Yeah, it's coming through okay now.
I took a little camera with, actual film, and then went to 1 hour photo and got the 1 hour photo done, and then I would tape them on the page, you know, with, it was really you know, like the first digital photos with little arrows and,
right.
This is broken, this doesn't work. And
that's awesome.
That was the beginning of that, and that was in California.
Okay.
With a handful of the properties that we first bought there.
Right. That's cool. So when did you move to the Dallas area and start investing there?
My wife and I moved here in 95.
Uh-huh.
And we moved to McKinney. And I wanted to do more buying. I wanted to try and average a house a year, you know, initially.
Uh-huh.
And I went to a few more seminars and, you know, boot camps, you know, trying to figure out, you know, how to do all this.
Right.
And went to one that was more, I can't remember the guy's name, but it was more oriented towards, you know, buying and holding and renting them out and just and building up a portfolio of rent houses.
Right.
And hiring on the income, you know, on the cash flow, because eventually they'll start to pay themselves down and, you know, hopefully you'll have a better cash flow, you know, in, say, 10 years or so.
Right.
By holding the property and then just renting it out. And so that kind of got started in McKinney, and I bought, my wife and I bought a house. We were buying a couple of houses at a time, and then we bought and sold a lot of them. So I would buy the house and sell it right, you know, almost right away.
Oh, okay.
And I remember one house that I bought was a little bit more than I was used to buying. So now I was trying to buy the $75,000, you know, fixers, you know, and so this house was much more. It was like it was closer to 130, 140, and if I was going to rent it, I was going to need about $1,200 or $1,300 a month in rent just to make mortgage and maybe have a couple of $100 in cash flow.
You know? Right.
And so once I realized that, and I had a much more difficult time finding a good tenant that was willing to pay that much money in monthly payments, I found out through this house that you want to try and keep your target rent, at just under $1,000 if you can. If it's possible to, you know, rent the house out for $975, then rent it out for $975, or buy houses that you can rent out for $975.
Is that because
not break that $1,000 a month? Because usually people that can afford, you know, $1,200, $1,300, $1,400 in monthly rent could probably afford to buy a house.
Right.
That's kind of the problem I was running into. So the people that wanted to rent my big, I called it the big house, the people that wanted to buy or rent the big house were generally small families. They were in the middle of building their next house.
So they were
building their next house.
Right.
And so they needed something for like 3, 4, 5, 6 months.
So they weren't going to stay for years.
And that's all they needed.
Yeah.
And so they weren't going to stay. You know, meanwhile, I have houses that are renting, you know, around $800, $900 a month that I've had those renters for, I don't know, 3, 4 years.
Uh-huh.
They're the same people.
Yeah.
You know, and every year I just raise the rent, you know, a couple, maybe 10, 20 bucks, you know, a couple percent.
Right.
And, but, you know, I kind of learned the hard way that once you get up into that $1,300, $1,400 and up rental bracket, then the dynamics kind of change.
Right.
So I sold that house.
Okay. That wasn't going to work too well for you. So you kind of learned that just by trial and error. As you got that house, you realized, hey, there's not as much demand for it, and the people that are applying aren't going to be here very long, so let's go with the smaller homes where I can rent.
Right, and then Lifestyles came along, and Dell came along, and it's, you know, I'm sitting in the two-day, and I'm going, yeah, yeah.
You could relate to that.
You're right. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he even pulls up on the MLS, like, how many properties are for rent in the different price points. And you get up over $1,000 a month, and there's properties that are sitting there. Nobody's renting them. You know,
yeah, and they'll sit there for months.
Yeah, exactly. So with the investing that you're doing currently, what kind of financing you're getting? How are you financing your properties?
This latest one we paid cash for.
That's the student one you just bought?
Yeah.
Okay.
One in Fort Worth. So we paid cash out of a 401k stock market funds that we wanted to. We're trying to get out of the.
Okay.
Out of the cash business and getting into the, you know, something you have a little bit more control over. You know, you don't have any control over the piece of paper that you hold in your hand from some other company that, you know, you just don't have any control over.
So did you just sell, you had stock or something in there, mm-hmm. and you just sold it, cashed it out, and went and put it into a house?
Yes.
That's interesting. What do you, did you calculate, like look at the difference. If I leave it in that account, what it's going to, you know, project what it'll grow versus if I take it and invest it in real estate, what it'll grow. What's the difference there?
Oh, yeah, I mean, if you want to roll the dice, you know, and find out, you know, who knows what the stock market and the values are going to be even 6 months from now.
Right. You can't. Yeah. You can't.
Company's going to be taken over, and the stock's going to be, you know, liquidated, and then you're out.
Right.
So, you know, it just. It can, you know, that's the nice thing about real estate is it's never worth zero. It's kind of like gold, you know.
Yeah.
You never lose your entire investment.
Because there's a physical asset.
Yeah, you're actually, you can hold something in your hand with that. And, you know, the 401ks and the stock market, and, you know, all the stuff that we were used to be involved in, you just can't trust it. And it's not, I mean, you know, you take $100,000 and you invest it in a house, and it's a whole lump sum of $100,000, and it's paying you back every month, say, $1,000. So you're making $1,000 back every month, you know, regardless.
Right.
As opposed to maybe contributing $1,000 to a 401k plan.
Yeah.
That's not paying you every month $1,000, you know. So all I have is taxes, you know, just basic hard expense like taxes, you know, utilities, and maintenance, you know, general maintenance.
But there's no mortgage payment because you bought it with cash.
So there's no, I mean, that's all cash flow.
Yeah.
You know, minus the maybe a couple $100 a month in, you know, if you want to put it in a reserve. Which I have done also. You put maybe a couple $100 a month in a reserve account for improvement,
right?
You know, or repair. You know, unforeseen repairs. It's kind of like a warranty program,
right? Your own, your self-funded warranty.
Self-funded warranty program, and you're not paying. You know, you only pay for it if you need it.
Yeah.
But you know, when you compare those types of returns, you know, there's just no comparison. You can't find it anywhere else.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting comparison that you draw where, on the one hand, a retirement account, you're pumping money into it every month trying to build it up, whereas with an investment
fund, hoping it'll be there.
Yeah, and hoping it'll be there. It's an asset you can't control, so you keep dumping money into it. Whereas an investment property, your experience is that you put the money into it, and then it starts paying you back and paying you back and paying you back. Are you finding that the, like the tax benefits of having it in real estate versus a stock market account or something like that, or are you finding a benefit there too?
Well, yeah, it's called depreciation. You know, you can depreciate the asset where you can't depreciate anything else. So, you know, that's just part of your, you know, you can still kind of zero it out at the end of the year as far as the income goes. You know, the income that I make all year long because of the depreciation can pretty much zero it out.
So you end up having no income tax essentially because you're writing off through depreciation and stuff.
Right. Yeah. That and you know, any expenses and, you know, write off your, you know, you reach a point where you don't really have that much repair expense. You know, like, once I get through this first month, I'll probably, you know, I'll do all my spending on this property in the next month, and then I'll be done.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because what a lot of people ask me and other investors is, well, how do I deal with all, you know, an expensive repair that comes up? What if the AC goes out, for example? Yeah. And the answer is what you just said. When you buy the property, put, you know, fix it, make sure it's working and it's going to work for the next 5 or 10 years, and you don't have to worry about it.
Right. I go through, and if I have a 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old AC unit, I'll just replace it.
Yeah, because you know it's going to only last.
I have a 12-year-old water heater that, you know, might be in the attic, and God forbid something happens to this water heater, you know, over the weekend while my tenants are away. Nobody knows that it's leaking. And so it causes all these thousands of dollars worth of damage because a pipe broke or something happened where it started leaking.
Right.
Rather than having to deal with getting a plumber out there on a Sunday morning because my good tenant that I'm trying to keep, you know, keep happy, and, you know, you try to make them happy, and that's why you have a tenant for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
Because, you treat them like humans, and, you know, you're nice to them. So yeah. Sunday morning they call me up and they say, hey, I got a bad, you know, the water, I don't have any hot water. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, no, what do I do?
Yeah.
So, you know, then it's panic time. So in order to avoid stuff like that, you go into the house and you evaluate the water heater and the furnace, especially the furnace, because you can kind of do without an air conditioner. You know, if the air conditioner breaks in the middle of summer, I mean, really, you could do without it. But, you know, in the middle of January, your furnace goes out, and, you know, you're talking about your property that the pipes are going to freeze because there's no heat. Your tenant's going to be really mad because they don't have any heat. You know, you can't live without heat.
Right.
You know? Especially in North Dallas, because the weather can be so extreme.
That's real.
So anyway, you want to look for things like that. And that's what I do in my home inspection, too, is whenever I do a home inspection for somebody buying a house, I'll tell them, you know, that this water heater is 15 years old.
Yeah.
It's working okay, and it's, you know, kind of installed okay. Most of them are not. But, you know, the furnace might be an old standing pilot-like type furnace, you know, where it has a, you know, it doesn't even have an automatic igniter.
Right.
That's an old furnace.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just replace it. Furnaces are nothing.
Uh-huh.
And they're nothing. And neither are water heaters. I mean, I just bought a water heater at Home Depot for $185,
$190.
Uh-huh. Electric water. And I could have probably had it installed for another $180, $200.
Yeah.
You know. So it's not that big of an expense.
Right. Yeah, so just get it done when you buy the property. Factor that into your cost of repairs and whatever to get the property up to the level it needs to be. And then you don't have to worry about, you know, big expensive repairs. And, as you said, right, unhappy tenants when things break.
Right, right. Yeah, you want to try to avoid that.
Yeah. Yeah, good. So when you go and do an inspection, what are the types of stuff that you're looking for? Obviously, like you just said, you're looking for, you know, what's the age of, the water heater and giving the new homeowner that information. But what else are you looking for?
Well, that and the roof, you know, the roof and all the big, I call them the big ticket items. You know, you want to try to get a handle on the foundation and the roof, the exterior, the envelope itself, so that, you know, the exterior, the walls, windows, doors, everything that's, but those are big ticket items that if they're not right, they cost you money in the end. You know, if you have leaky windows and single pane windows that are, you know, just not very energy efficient, you're going to have higher, you know, energy bills, you have higher, possibility of water leaks in doors.
Right.
Doors are not sealed properly. You know, you get water coming in around the weather stripping, or because it's not closing properly. And then, of course, the roof. I mean, I'll give you my opinion on the roof, you know, in a minute.
Okay.
I'll just tell you, you know, this roof is reaching the end of its useful life. You're going to have to do something. If you don't do something about it now, then you'll have to do something about it later whenever you go to sell.
Right.
Because it's going to be an issue. So a lot of times, you know, I'll tell a buyer, prospective buyer, that, yeah, you can probably get another 5 years or so out of the roof, and, you know, it'll probably be okay. You know, maybe you could pray for a hailstorm.
Yeah, get the insurance to cover.
Or a small tornado.
Yeah, just one just enough to damage the roof, yeah. And nothing else.
Just enough to do roof damage.
Right.
And then maybe, you know, you might be able to get a little bit of help from the insurance company on replacing it.
Right.
But sometime in the near future, you're going to have to replace it.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, a lot of times, you'll find a roof that has just been replaced a couple of years ago because of a hailstorm. But
right.
They still have problems with them. I mean, you know, they just, a lot of times they just don't install them properly.
Yeah.
That's the same problem I have with air conditioners and water heaters and roofs too. They just don't. I don't know where they're finding these roofers. They're just not doing a good job.
Are you finding that when you're inspecting older homes, it's a bigger problem than with newer homes? Or are you still seeing issues with newer homes?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Newer homes. I just inspected a new home. It was probably $300,000 new house, 3,500 square feet maybe.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, you know, it's a new house, and I like doing new houses. And recently, I haven't been because I've been doing a lot of, you know, foreclosures and empty houses and vacant properties because that's pretty much all it's selling right now.
Right.
So here, you know, here's this builder. He finally found a buyer for this house. It's been built. It's been fixed or finished for a year.
Yeah.
And we finally found one. You know, and so anyway, the buyer hires me to do a home inspection. I do an inspection on. I spent almost more time on that house than I did on an older house that was 20 years old.
Oh, really?
Had so many problems. They forgot to insulate part of the attic. Some of the shingles were just installed like wrong. They just installed them wrong. Just very basic things that they didn't do. They had water heaters up in the attic without pans. You know, you're supposed to put a pan under the water heater, especially if you have it up in the attic.
Yeah.
And just had the water heater sitting in the attic.
Wow. Any small leak and it's going straight down through the ceiling.
I couldn't believe it, but I think also one of the problems with that is that the house was out in the county. I won't tell you what county it was, but it was like, we call it just like out in the county. So it's out of the city jurisdiction of the building department.
Okay.
So they only have to go through so many inspections, and the builder, you know, kind of gets a slide, you know.
Yeah.
Doesn't have that many inspectors.
Yeah.
Like you would say maybe in Frisco or Plano or, you know, the city of Dallas, city of Fort Worth, you know, you have to jump through hoops to build a house there in those cities. But whenever you build out in the country, you know, pretty much anything goes.
And you see probably anything.
Country, then, you know, definitely get a home inspection.
Yeah. So I'm curious, what is the worst condition property you've ever inspected? Like, what did you see? What was it like?
I don't know. That's tough. Because, I mean, I've seen...
You've seen everything.
Doing this since, you know, the late 80s, and I've seen an awful lot of really bad housing. But I remember one that I did that was... I think it was a HUD... HUD-owned home that... It didn't have a roof.
Oh, really?
No, the roof was gone.
Wow.
Apparently, somehow it blew off, or a portion of it blew off, and nobody ever fixed it. And meanwhile, this house sat vacant. sat empty.
Huh.
It was like the people just left. They just packed up their bathroom bag, you know, full of bathroom stuff and a change of socks and left.
So all their furniture was there?
Yeah, everything was, I mean, the newspaper was on the counter. And it was just like somebody just up and left. So anyway, over time, this was probably over a year that, you know, the rain was coming in and it ruined the whole house.
Wow.
The whole house was just completely watered.
Yeah.
This was just as I was starting to get into mold and mold remediation, mold assessment, and so the house was just full of mold. I could only spend feet, and I have a breathing apparatus, like a face mask with filters on it.
Yeah.
I run into a situation like that, I can put the mask on right away, and I can still continue to walk around. So I couldn't spend 10 minutes in that house. It was that bad.
Wow.
I started getting a headache, you know, and my eyes were watering.
Yeah.
This house says mold in it.
Yeah,
so that was a really bad house.
Wow. I can imagine that would be crazy. Was somebody actually buying it and they were paying you to go do the inspection?
Yeah. Somebody was going to buy it, and I said, I think I told them, I could get him a good deal on a bulldozer.
Yeah. You just didn't see a way to salvage that.
It was not savable. I mean, it just needed to be, you know, wrecking ball.
Yeah. All right.
Because I think I only went through it. I don't even think I finished. I mean, because once I got inside and I started, you know, evaluating the exterior, I couldn't stay inside. I just told him, I said, no, I can't finish this before.
Yeah. Oh, man. Wow.
So
we can get it into the transcript, I want to make sure that that people know that your company is called DFWinspectors.com. Is that correct?
It's one inspector.
One inspector.
DFW inspector.
Oh, I'm sorry. DFWinspector.com, singular.
Okay.
Do you just do single family properties, or do you inspect more?
No, I pretty much inspect everything.
Commercial, retail,
multifamily. I've done. I just did a chain of a Boston Market restaurant.
Oh, really? Interesting.
The guy was buying three Boston Market restaurants. In the DFW area.
Right.
So I did those for him, and I do everything. I just treat it like a really big home inspection.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I'm curious about that. If you're in like a restaurant or that kind of commercial retail space, are there different things that you have to look for in the plumbing? Like, is the plumbing different than it would be in a house? Or?
No, not really.
Yeah.
Even, and it's like for apartment buildings, apartment complexes and multifamilies, I just treat them as a really big home inspector. Pretty much the same. The only thing that you run into differently with an apartment complex is how it's heated and cooled.
Okay.
A lot of times they'll have a boiler and what they call a two-pipe chiller system with a cooling tower outside.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, it gets pretty technical, but it's a different way of heating and cooling. Usually older apartment complexes are heated and cooled like that. It's kind of a central, central heating and cooling plant.
Right.
Sends cold or hot water out to the apartments.
I see.
So anyway, that's like one of the bad and commercial pool equipment. So I'll inspect swimming pools and pool equipment let's see what else. In roofing. Roofing is a little bit different in commercial, you know, because they use different materials and different methods of roofing and construction. So, like, a lot of times you'll see steel trusses, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot of different things in structure in larger buildings like that.
Right.
I've done four, I think it was a five-story office complex, roughly, I think it was 60,000 square feet, 10,000 square feet per floor. So it was 60,000.
Okay. So how long does it? Yeah.
It takes a couple days.
A couple days. Yeah, I was going to ask. It sounds like that would be a major job because you look at everything, don't you? I mean, you run the water on every sink, you flush the toilet, and look at every wall, every window. Pretty expensive.
Yeah, and I do that. I do that on home inspection. I do that on apartment complex. I do that on, Boston Market restaurant. I mean, you go in the ladies' room and, anybody in there?
Yeah, make sure it's clear.
And you check everything.
Uh-huh.
The only thing I don't look at in a restaurant, for example, would be the restaurant equipment.
Right.
Because it's usually the restaurant companies, that's their thing, So I'm just looking at the structural
parts of it.
Structural mechanical part. And I guess apartment complexes and multifamily can all be really related to residential.
Uh-huh.
Just like inspecting a big house, like I said. Because you have attic, and you have attic crawl spaces, and you have foundation. Sometimes they're built on a pier and beam, and you have foundation crawl spaces, and
uh-huh.
you have inspectors. Uh-huh. I have a couple of inspectors that work with me, my partner Gary, some Lifestyles members have met him, I think. So we'll go in with a crew, and get it done.
Okay, so yeah, it's not one person.
No, it's not just me walking around.
Okay.
I'd be here forever.
Do they, when you're doing a big apartment complex, do you actually go into every single unit, even if they're occupied? You have to, you do that?
Most of them.
Yeah.
We normally don't do, the only time I'll do all of the units is usually in a smaller complex. Like if we're only, if we're talking about an 8-plex or a 10-plex, or maybe even just like up to about 15 units in a small apartment complex, we'll probably go through all of them.
Uh-huh.
Maybe one or two of them you can't get into because they changed the lock or a lot of times you run into what they call day sleepers because
they work all night.
They work the night shift,
yeah.
And they come home, and then they lock their door from the inside. You can't get in.
Yeah.
So then the manager usually says, "Well, no, we can't get in there." But that's usually what we do for the smaller ones, and then the larger complexes, like I've done even like 200 units, and we'll usually do 25% or so, and that'll kind of depend on. How many buildings there are. If you have a large complex of 200, let's say, you might have 10 apartments per building, and you have 20 buildings.
Right.
So you actually go around to all 20 buildings and treat them like 20 big houses.
I see.
20 10-plex.
Yeah.
And so with that building in mind, uh-huh. you just pick one building, so there might be, you label them, so building A, and then you might only see four, let's say.
Okay.
I see three or four interiors in that building.
I see.
Unless there might be something, because a lot of times the buyer, or sometimes they have a buyer's group, a group of investors, will be walking around at the same time.
Yeah,
and a lot of times they'll go in and go. I said, well, you go into all the vacant ones,
right?
They're easy to get into. You don't deal with anything. Just go look at the vacant ones, and then if you see anything out of the ordinary, or if you see any mold, or something that you have a question about, then call me over. Call me up. I'll go over and take a look at it. But I usually send them off, and you go look at all the vacant ones, and let them go back to work.
Right. Don't let us go crawl through the attic space.
Right, let me go do the crawling.
When you're working with single family investors, people investing in houses, are you okay with them kind of shadowing you on the inspection so they can see what's going on?
Yeah, I always recommend that.
Yeah. I know that's what I like to do when I have my properties invested because it just gives me, the reports are really good and they're very detailed, but if I've also seen it firsthand, it just gives me a better feel, I guess, for what I'm dealing with.
Yeah, it's always good to have the buyer there. Even if you can't be there for the entire thing, try to maybe show up an hour late, you know, and spoke for maybe the last half of the inspection.
Right.
I always recommend it.
Yeah, good.
Because you'd be amazed what you learn.
Yeah, as an investor, you really do learn a lot. In fact, at this point, I don't feel the need to shadow the inspector anymore. But I did on the first three or four properties because I learned so much about it that it was
a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's what there's two different aspects to this, you know, whether or not to get an inspection or not, and this is how I usually see it. First, I see the investor on their initial homes, so I might see them for their maybe first 5 or 10. Houses that they bought.
Yeah.
And I don't see them anymore. And then maybe 6 months later, they'll call me back and they'll say, well, you know, I have this house and I have that house and I have this house. And, you know, so what they do is they reach a point where they just don't have the time. They don't have the time to go there.
Right.
So now they've reached a point where they're comfortable with not even visiting the property.
Right. And they get the inspection report. And because they've been so involved earlier, they get the inspection report. They know exactly what – they know how to interpret it and what everything means. And, yeah, that's
– once you reach that point, then you're an investor.
Yeah.
Because it's just numbers.
Yeah.
You know, the house is just a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the numbers and everything is, you know, equal – and from your past experiences on other houses, how much you'd normally pay. So you say, well, I'm only going to pay $15,000 worth of remodeling or $10,000 worth of remodeling on this house. And so if all the numbers, you know, make sense and the purchase price is right and, you know, all the, you know, the deal is otherwise okay.
Yeah.
And call me to go do the inspection. I'll send you an inspection report that might be 20-some-odd pages of photos and comments and, you know, this is what the roof looks like and, you know, I think you ought to replace this and the water heater is really old. So anyway, go through the whole report and then compare that with your, you know, your idea of what you want to pay for repairs. Yeah. And you can make a decision from your desk.
Yeah.
You know, you don't even have to go there.
Exactly.
I have a lot of people that have now, especially in lifestyle, because I deal with some other networks too. That have reached that point now, you know, where we saw them on the first, you know, handful of properties, and then I don't hear from them for a while, and I think, well, maybe they're taking a break or something, you know. and then they call me up and they say, you know, well, I have, you know, this week I have this house, and then next week I have this house, you know, so. And this one's in Mesquite, and this one's in Garland. And,
yeah, it's like...
I mean, they're everywhere, you know. This one's in Fort Worth. And,
yeah.
You know, are you going to be there? No, I'm not going to be there. Just give me the report, you know.
Just got to take care of it for me.
Yeah, exactly. So you kind of, that's kind of the timeline, I guess, of the investor, you know.
Yeah.
Once you reach maturity, you know, and you get to the point where you just don't need to be there.
Yeah.
Anymore, because you're comfortable with it. You know, once you have to reach that comfort level.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's really key. Is you do need to reach that comfort level, and you get to the point where it's not an emotional decision anymore. I think a lot of first time investors feel a lot of emotion, like as if they were buying the house to live in. It's
right.
That's investing is a totally different approach.
So, yeah, you have to pull yourself out.
Uh-huh.
And have to, like, have an out-of-body experience.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it.
You have to look at yourself buying this property for somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, and as long as you can do that and remove yourself and your own emotions and keep saying to yourself, I am not going to live here.
Right.
Because so many people make that mistake. I mean, they go in and, I don't want granite countertops and, you know, I want a nice, $500 cooktop.
Mm-hmm.
You spend all this money on stuff that, I always ask myself, before I do any remodeling, am I going to be able to get more rent for the house if I do that?
Oh, that's a good question.
Is it going to get me more rent, or am I going to be able to rent it faster
right.
if I do that?
Right.
So, countertops are not going to
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been a great discussion, Rudy. I really appreciate your time today because I've learned a lot. We had a really good conversation about, taking retirement funds and putting those into real estate rather than, leaving them in the stock market and that sort of thing. That was really good. And the things that you talked about with the inspections was really helpful too. I think people are going to really enjoy the interview and benefit from it. So was there anything that we didn't cover that you feel like you'd like to share?
Well, you brought up you use the investment funds and buying the house for cash, and I know there's a lot of members that have done that, and what we're going to plan on doing maybe in the near future, not so distant future, is to refinance it and pull the cash back out, and even if you just get a 50% loan to value, which should be easy to get. You should be able to get 50% loan to value house,
right?
Home mortgage, pull that cash out and go in.
Exactly. Yeah.
You might have to get more of a mortgage on the next one.
Yeah.
But I think my closing costs, which I never occurred to me how much it costs. In closing costs, I think the closing costs were like a couple hundred dollars.
When you did the cash purchase?
HUD sheet.
Right.
Because there weren't any loan fees, there weren't any doc fees, there weren't any appraisals, no surveys, all those expenses that are on your closing sheet, you don't have them.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I've actually bought two houses with cash so far, and I find that the closings, there's a lot less paperwork.
It's so much easier.
It's so much easier. You can close so much faster, and you can get better deals, too, because a lot of the sellers want to see cash. I'm sorry, you cut out. What was that?
Less stressful.
Yes, less stressful. That's right. Absolutely. So great advice. I'm going to, as I promote and explain to people what we talked about, I think that's going to be one of the highlights. Sounds like we've got a buzzer going off in the other room. Hopefully that's not coming off on the interview. Can you hear that beeping sound?
Yeah, I hear it somewhere.
Yeah, nobody's in there to turn it off. So, oh well, these interviews aren't perfect, right? So, they're not television quality.
Editing in this?
That's right. I could go back and edit, but sometimes I just like it the way it is. We'll see. Anyway, well, thank you, Rudy, so much. I appreciate it. And if anybody wants to get an idea of your business, just go to dfwinspector.com, and they can find out what you do there, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm also on the vendor list.
Excellent. Okay. So look for you there. And just so you know, it'll probably it takes a couple weeks to get the transcript done for the interview and get published. So you look for it here in a couple weeks.
It's also Rudy at DFW Inspectors by email.
Oh, Rudy at DFW
Inspectors. Rudy at DFWinspector.com.
Excellent. All right. Thank you so much, Rudy. Appreciate it. We'll be in touch. It was good getting to know you.
See you.
Bye-bye.